The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Dan Bardell.
And I'm Flo Lloyd-Hughes.
And welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. It's Wednesday, which means we'll be picking out some of the best work available on The Athletic right now and putting the authors under the spotlight.
There was a word beginning with N that some football fans used to shout at players like me. They don't do it anymore.
There was a word beginning with P that some football fans used to shout at players like me, but they don't do that anymore either.
But for some reason, a lot of fans still shout this word, and it begins with Y.
What they're chanting is a racist word for Jews, the Y word.
This week, two guests, one theme, as Spurs correspondent for The Athletic, Charlie Eccleshare, joins us to discuss the amazing article on Tottenham and its weird and outdated relationship with the Y word. An important topic, one which is of course not limited to the N17 postcode area. And conveniently enough for us, news editor Amitai Winehouse has been working on a fantastic article of his own entitled Jewish or Leeds, the religions coexist side by side. And he'll join us as well.
Yeah, read that this morning. Really, really interesting read. We'll say hello to the guys in just a moment, but first, Flo, it's finally happened. Let's talk about Solskjaer's time at Old Trafford coming to an end. An absolute humbling at Watford, the exit video, Conte being at Spurs, weird contract extensions. It's a little bit of a mess.
Yeah, just a tad. I mean, the whole thing has been so strange, really, hasn't it, from start to finish. Him getting the interim spot. I mean, we've done an episode about clubs picking old players, you know, that nostalgia around it and why they do it and building relationships, and none more so sort of legendary and important at the time than Solskjaer's appointment, which so many people thought wasn't the best idea in terms of his experience and his record, but they needed some feel-good factor, and his departure has been all about that feel-good factor as well, or attempting to do that in some kind of strange PR and marketing form. But just so bizarre from start to finish, the whole saga that started, what, in 2019? And here we are, just, a bizarre time. So getting him to sign that contract in the summer when people already, you know, the whole of last season had said he's probably not good enough for the job. Just really, really strange. And it's also really, I think, been quite a toxic time in the Manchester United fan base as well. So as much as the club want to sort of dress it up as bringing the feel-good factor back to Old Trafford, you know, when we think of our Athletic colleague Carl Anka and some of the abuse he's had to face from Manchester United supporters on Twitter, I think Solskjaer coming in and the way he's admired by supporters and then matching up with performances on the pitch, you know, it's created a bit of a toxic atmosphere, and then the backdrop of the Super League and all this kind of stuff. So I think for a lot of people, this is a really good opportunity to move on. And we talked about Spurs longing for Conte since last summer, and the fact that United have been sort of salivating over Pochettino ever since he left Spurs. Maybe finally everyone can move on. United can get Pochettino. Spurs have got Conte now. Maybe Pochettino will come back at some point. But I feel like there's so many situations here where it's like, right, this whole weird, bizarre, toxic situation, people can move on now, because that departure video, I think, just really summed up how weird the last few years have been.
Now, Carl can feel very vindicated with what's happened, because he was absolutely bang on, and he even got a name check from Ian Wright on Match of the Day on Saturday. I don't know whether you saw that, Flo. So, yeah, vindication for Carl. But the weird thing is that, you know, they're probably going to have to go the route for the rest of the season where they do exactly the same thing again of getting an ex-player in to manage the football club. And then they said this on the Totally Football show yesterday. What happens if he does well?
Yeah, I know.
They could find himself in exactly the same
pattern. I know. And I think it's going to be hard to see how United really try and build again, because every single time I think they think it's going to happen, it doesn't work out. And who knows whether Pochettino, if he does eventually go there, will be the person to sort of restore that. But it does feel like it's going to be really difficult to know when it's finally sort of calm and it's finally they're actually, you know, what they need to be, because at the moment, they've sort of tried to just stick a plaster over things by spending lots of money on incredibly talented players, and it hasn't worked. So what next? You know, what next, really?
Plenty of Manchester United content on The Athletic at the moment. And in case you missed it, make sure you go back and listen to Monday's show with Chappers, where the likes of David Ornstein and Manchester United correspondent Laurie Whitwell take you inside Solskjaer's dismissal. Certainly worth a listen. As I say, plenty of writing around Manchester United right now. It's seriously, seriously good. So if you're not a subscriber to The Athletic for some reason, you are in luck, because it's Black Friday week, and with that comes the best deal of the year. You can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of just £1 a month for a full 12 months. Do hurry, as the offer ends at midnight on Monday the 29th of November. You'll enjoy all the great analysis and in-depth features that comes from having the very best football writers around, and you will also get ad-free versions of all the podcasts, including this one. As I say, just go to theathletic.com/footballpod to take advantage of this best ever offer. That's theathletic.com/footballpod. Let's bring Charlie in then. Charlie, welcome to the show. Your article is a collaboration with colleague Jack Pitbrook and is entitled "The Spurs Fans and the Why Word, What Happens Next?" And I understand this is a topic that's really close to your heart, isn't it? And it's a very important topic as well.
Yeah. It's been something I've wanted to write for a while. For the kind of broader picture, I guess, of anti-Semitism, you know, societally and football, and kind of everywhere. But yeah, the Spurs and the Y word, it's just such a complicated topic. And it was not an easy piece to write, because there's just so much to unpack, so many different perspectives. But I guess the starting point is the fact that Spurs fans sing this word, as we know, and identify as various forms of Y words. And it dates back to the 1970s, when Spurs, who've always had a strong Jewish fan base, so kind of became known as the Jewish club, even though there are lots of other clubs with big Jewish fan bases, like Arsenal, West Ham, Leeds United, who my colleague Amitai and Phil Hay did a piece on. But Spurs were known as the Jewish club, and in the 70s, there was horrific anti-Semitic abuse that they received from opposition fans, you know, clubs like Chelsea. And so they began to self-identify as the Y words, as a kind of badge of honor, as a way of deflecting the racism. And this was taken on by kind of all the fan base and has developed over time to become synonymous just with Tottenham. But there's an issue, because it is a racial slur. It's a hate word. It was used in Nazi Germany. It was used by Oswald Mosley and the black shirts in the 1930s. It's an insult, and it's a horrible word, really. And so while the intentions may be good, and I think they are good, you know, from Spurs fans, it's a term of endearment almost. And to be honest, you know, a lot of Spurs fans don't even know what this word means, especially the younger fans. True of opposition fans as well. This is what Chelsea's research has shown in their attempts to root out anti-Semitism. They just think it means Tottenham, in the way that Gunners means Arsenal, or, you know, you might call Liverpool the Scousers or whatever. So that's kind of how it's developed. And the big issue is that only 5% roughly of match-going Tottenham fans are actually Jewish. So 95% of the fans that are using this word are not. And when you actually stop and think about that, it is like, you know, a predominantly, you know, a 95% white fan base using the N-word or the P-word or this sort of thing. And put like that is very, very strange. And the big thing for me on this piece, because I wanted to, you know, genuinely get a sense from mainly Jewish Spurs fans, but also some non-Jewish Spurs fans as well, how they view it, because it's a really, really divisive issue. And the reason we came to write it now is Spurs launched a consultation on the topic a couple of years ago with their fans as to whether they wanted to sing it, whether they thought it was appropriate to keep singing it or not. And it was pretty split. You know, there wasn't a consensus. And then we learned that Tottenham are planning on, for the first time really, asking their fans to consider the appropriateness of using this word, which is quite a big step. And that's going to happen sometime in the new year. And that was based on both their consultation and on focus groups that they did. But the big thing really that came across to me in this piece is that actually what matters here is the view of the Jewish community, whether they support Spurs or not. Because when you think about a racial slur being used, the only real stakeholder that matters is the minority group that's being targeted with it. And something that really struck me was talking to a number of Jewish organizations and individuals from the Jewish community was that they feel very, very uncomfortable with hearing this word, because it doesn't happen in isolation. We think of it as it's a kind of Spurs thing. That's not the case. You know, in every Spurs game, there are opposition fans who hear the word. And that can be not a very nice experience for them, because you're hearing thousands of people singing a hate word. And even if it's done in this, you know, benevolent or certainly not designed to be insulting way, it's still not particularly nice for a lot of people hearing that word. And that was just something I heard again and again and again, and lots of Jewish organizations saying, please, can we stop using this word? And that there's no complete consensus. It's very complicated, and there are a lot of Jewish Spurs fans who love it. They love the fact that you know, it's almost like a celebration of the Jewish community. They feel very welcome. So it's not to say that all Jewish fans, and certainly not all Jewish Spurs fans, want an end to it. That's not the case. But there is a growing unease about this word, and ultimately they are the community that we need to listen to. So that was kind of an overview of the piece, but there's kind of lots to get into within it, because it's a very complicated topic.
And what is it, what sort of prompted it, in a sense that what's been so unique about right now about the club's approach to it, and what could that mean going forward as well?
I think partly what's prompted over the last couple of years is growing sensitivities about sort of cultural appropriation and things like that. So you've got, you know, rugby, Exeter Chiefs have come under pressure from Native American organizations to lose the Chiefs element of their name. I think it's Washington Redskins over in America as well. And there's lots of talk about how appropriate that is. So that context, plus growing anti-Semitism and a growing appreciation that, and again, this is where it becomes complicated, because it's not really about the clubs, but obviously this is football, so it becomes a tribal kind of us versus you element to it. But what tends to happen, and has happened for a long time, is that Spurs fans sing the Y word in this celebratory way. But we've all been to football grounds and we know how it works. It's kind of a call and response thing. So we sing one thing, the opposition fans respond with something else. And what often happens is you have Spurs fans singing about the Y word, and then a response from opposition fans with something outright anti-Semitic, be that a chant about the Holocaust or Auschwitz, you know, horrific things like that. And no one for a second is saying that Spurs fans singing just the Y word alone is as bad. But there is this unfortunate relationship that happens where those two things exist. And I think there is a growing appreciation that it's not that helpful. And also, I just think people, thankfully, are more aware of kind of the importance of talking to minority groups and trying to understand how they actually feel. And, you know, we live in this world where, thankfully, and especially in football, there's so much about anti-racism. And I think the penny's just starting to drop a bit that it's very strange that we have that commitment. And yet it does seem as if we're happy to almost overlook the anti-Semitism, both that Spurs fans face, but also just the fact that, not that Tottenham fans are being anti-Semitic, but the fact that it is uncomfortable for a lot of people to have to hear this word. And there is just this, what I find so strange is that every game at Tottenham, or certainly at the vast majority of games, you have the players take the knee and the commentator says how committed we are to tackling all forms of discrimination. And then that happens. And then seconds later, tens of thousands of people are singing this racial slur, and no one thinks that that's weird.
And what are the club doing right now?
Well, I mean, until they've always been very quiet on the matter, really. They don't associate with the Y word. So you'll never see the Y word in, you know, on any of their official gear or in the club shop or anything like that. They won't communicate or follow or interact in any way with social media accounts that have the Y word in their handle and their biography, et cetera, et cetera. Players are told, you know, don't use that word. So they've always had a distance from it. They've always, you know, tried to see it as it's a fans thing. But this forthcoming request to ask fans to think about the appropriateness of it will be the first time they've really taken a public stance on it. And that is...
I mean, what does that, I guess for me, what does that really mean? To say, you know, consider the appropriateness? Because I think what I find really frustrating about football clubs, and this is across all discrimination, is there is a very hands-off approach, because they obviously, and obviously social media has made it worse, because there's a whole digital world which they can essentially say, it's not our problem. Mm. What's going on in there? We can't do anything. We can't police the internet. And I sometimes find that football clubs often take the same approach in the grounds as well, which is, we can't, you know, we're not going to be able to police all the fans' behaviour. So do you think that's a strong enough approach, just to say, consider the appropriateness, you know?
I totally see that. I think one of the issues that clubs have, and this may well be interpreted as a very generous reading of it, but I do think, from speaking to fans, both Jewish and non-Jewish, and from other clubs, there is an acceptance that if the club is to come down on them like a ton of bricks and say to fans, you can't sing that word, you cannot sing that word, it just becomes a sort of us v you. And this almost happened a few years ago. So the FA suddenly decided that they were going to clamp down on this kind of thing. And three Spurs...
I remember that video. There was the Gary Lineker and a few others.
That was the Y Word video. And that was actually led by David Baddiel and his brother Ivor, and I spoke to David for the piece. But that kind of ties into one of the issues, is that who the messenger is super important here. And so if it's Spurs... And first of all, fans don't like being told what to do. We know that. And so the fear is that what happened then was there were arrests made of Tottenham fans singing the Y word. Now, two things happened. One, they're saying, well, how can you get at us when we're hearing genuinely anti-Semitic songs about the Holocaust, etc.? Secondly, when those arrests were made and then it collapsed because they realized they couldn't take it to trial, etc., Spurs fans then developed a chant about, you tried to stop us and look what it did. What I love most is being a Y word. So then it becomes a kind of even more defiance. So learning from that and trying to understand the importance of it being the right messenger, they feel at this stage anyway, it has to be about encouraging people to have conversations and trying to understand why it is they shouldn't use this word. You know, giving people the proper context. And to be fair to them, some of the people I spoke to said that they do kind of agree with this approach, that it can't be really a crackdown as such. It has to be an awareness raising campaign, but that they also acknowledge, the people I spoke to, that they have to go all in, but this shouldn't just be about the club, because this affects everyone. And there almost has to be two things. There has to be an awareness campaign for Tottenham fans about the Y word and how it can offend people, how it can trigger people. But also more widely, for other clubs, there has to be a conversation about anti-Semitism more broadly. But there are issues about, who gets across this message? Because I spoke to David Baddiel for the piece, and David launched the Y Word campaign in 2011. What the problem is that David is speaking as a Jew. You know, that is where he's coming from. That is his perspective on this. And it's about, how do Jews feel when they hear this word and then hear what comes from it? But often it's taken as, you're a Chelsea fan. Who are you as a Chelsea fan to tell Spurs fans what to think? So it's so delicate. I mean, I am confident. I do think that over time, the way society is moving, or I hope anyway, that there will be a growing acceptance that this isn't really appropriate. And ultimately, it's as simple as, it's a racial slur. A lot of people from that minority really, really don't like it. I mean, when you put it like that, I don't really see that that's arguable. And I think over time, people will appreciate that. But we've seen, these things do take time. Things are entrenched. But ultimately, you're asking fans to stop singing a word. They have plenty of other words they can use. As David says, never in the history of the world as a kind of racial slur been reclaimed by a group not from that minority group. I mean, it's crazy. It's just not really, it's not the 95% of non-Jewish Spurs fans. It's not really their word to reclaim. And I think eventually the message will get through. And there are a lot of, I've been encouraged because a lot of people, there are people on extremes in this situation, but a lot of people in the middle have responded to this article saying, it's not something I've ever really spoken about, but we want to be a progressive club. This just isn't right. So
David Baddiel is in quite a, like you say, he's in a unique position. First of all, I find it fascinating that he launched a campaign 10 years ago. And really, would you say, first question would be, are we any further forward than we were when he launched that campaign? Secondly, again, just because he's a Chelsea fan, why does that matter? Because he must feel uncomfortable, I'm imagining, at certain times when certain things are said at Chelsea-Spurs games. As a Chelsea fan, sat watching Chelsea play Spurs.
Yeah, well, on the first point, I asked him about that, and he felt, certainly speaking from a Chelsea perspective, that it has got quite a bit better. Obviously okay. Far from perfect, but there is less kind of the outright just kind of, you know, just singing. Because what, you know, Chelsea fans used to sing that word a lot, even when they weren't playing Spurs, just as a kind of hate word, just almost as like a tick. He says there is a bit less of that, and less of the a horrific chants about Auschwitz and this sort of thing. But you do still get some of it. But then to the second point, yeah, I mean, that is the thing. And this was what was such a kind of, what I think really stood out for me is that point that it doesn't matter if you support the club or not. If you're from that religion and you're hearing it, it can be really, really upsetting. You know, people I spoke to who have had it said to them, you know, or they, you know, a lot of people have parents or grandparents who fled Nazi Germany, etc., and they've had, you know, they've been persecuted and had that word thrown at them. It's a pretty horrific term, and so it can bring back some pretty nasty memories. And you know, for the Leeds game, you know, as I said, Leeds have a strong Jewish fan base, so a lot of them are having to hear that word and then cringing, knowing that once Spurs fans sing it, oh my, does that mean that some of my own supporters are going to respond with something like outright anti-Semitic? So yeah, there's a lot in there, and but yeah, I do think the situation hopefully will improve. But anti-Semitism more broadly, I mentioned the piece last year when figures came out, anti-Semitic hate crimes were the highest they've been. So, and you know, there's been a lot of anti-Semitism. You know, we've had West Ham fans singing a Hasidic Jew on a plane, you know, and things like that. And so it does, that's the thing, it does go beyond football. And as much as people can say, oh, it's just about Spurs, David Baddiel talks about as well, he's had people at Chelsea singing to him, you know, F the effing Y words and this sort of thing at him and his brother. So it's not just about Spurs. I think there's the fear is it licenses anti-Semitism, and also it complicates things for stewards, for supporters, because there is that element of, but no, tens of thousands of Spurs fans sing it every week and nothing happens. So what, I'm not allowed to say it? You know, it makes things too murky. And this is a situation that needs to be clarified rather than made more complicated.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast, and in a moment, Athletic News editor Amitai Winehouse will join the three of us to broaden the discussion from London to Leeds. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So we're going to carry on the discussion. A really interesting piece on The Athletic at the moment about a history which Dan and I were saying we literally had no idea about, but something that's really passionate to the author. And he joins us now for the second part of the podcast, Amitai Winehouse, who's news editor for The Athletic. And he, alongside Phil Hay, wrote a piece called Jewish or Leeds, The Religions Coexist Side by Side. Amitai, firstly, tell us why this was so important to you and is such a kind of, I guess, familiar narrative for you.
Well, it's a bit of a weird one. I think the reason we ended up doing this piece was a few weeks ago, amid sort of the scandal at Yorkshire Cricket Club, a story emerged on the Telegraph about Andrew Gale using anti-Semitic language towards what was at the time the Leeds United press officer, a guy called Paul Dews, who's not Jewish. And Andrew Gale deleted the tweet. This was about a decade ago. He apologised at the time and has apologised since as well. The reason he tweeted it in the first place is that he's a Huddersfield Town fan. And as someone who's followed Leeds United for my entire life and is a Jewish Leeds United fan. One of the weirdest things I found out when I was about 18 years old is that in certain pockets of Yorkshire, Leeds United have this reputation as a Jewish club. Now, like, I knew the sort of Jewish connections to Leeds United. I knew that most of my mates who were Jewish growing up were Leeds fans. I knew that so many of Leeds' owners have been Jewish people from Leeds. But I didn't actually realise there was this, like, almost like nasty element to it among fans of other clubs. And that sort of connection twigged in my head, and it's always sort of sat there. I wrote my dissertation about this when I was at university, and then sort of did this with Phil, and we very much sort of followed on from what had happened with Andrew Gale, this story re-emerging. There's actually a very nice story to be told about the Jewish community in Leeds and their, I think it's fair to say, like, obsession with Leeds United, actually.
Yeah, it made me feel good reading it this morning, because it was something that I wasn't aware of at all. You know, you've got all the Spurs stuff, which obviously isn't feel good at all, but it was nice to read that about the Leeds fans and the community and the way they go about supporting Leeds. It was really, really nice read.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of strangest elements of it, I thought, was that, you know, I spoke to Rabbi Gilbert, who was my rabbi. He was a reverend at the time, now a rabbi, and I think conducted my bar mitzvah, if I remember right. And, you know, you sort of speak to him, what is a man of God, and like, I don't know how much you guys know about, like, Shabbat traditions, basically, but, you know, you're not allowed to use electricity, you're not allowed to do any work, you're not allowed to drive, you're not allowed to, there's a whole list of things. And one of the things you're definitely not allowed to do, even though it's not mentioned in the Torah, the Jewish scripture, is go to Elland Road and watch Leeds United play. And I remember I spoke to the rabbi about this, and it was really strange to just hear him be, like, completely accepting of the fact that he knew that at least, like, a significant pocket of his congregation goes to watch Leeds on a weekly basis. So I really enjoyed that. And then the fact that, you know, these people that I know, Simon Field, who I sort of went to school with, who's an obsessive Leeds fan, and I'm pretty sure, you know, as he says in the piece, apart from the high holy days, wouldn't miss a Leeds game for anything. Louise Levin, who is someone I've known for a long time, her family are Leeds United obsessives, and she tells this lovely story in there about, I think it's her nephew asked her once, are we Jewish or are we Leeds? And the answer is both. But, like, that is the identity that sort of Louise has, that a lot of Leeds-based Jews have about Leeds United. I thought it was a really nice story, basically, or a few anyway.
I think as well, like, we've focused on the negatives with talking about the Y word and Spurs, but it's also a really heartwarming story at its heart, you know, because it is, when you actually look back at it, that it was, as I say, this kind of solidarity with the Jewish community. And that's why a lot of Jewish Spurs fans are still in favor of the Y word and like the fact that they feel this sense of belonging. And speaking to people from, you know, Jewish community organizations and that sort of thing, they love the idea of Tottenham celebrating their Jewish heritage, their Jewish history. Those things are really important. It's just that word that causes the issue and that a lot of people are uncomfortable with. But there are, you know, as Amitai says with Leeds, there are, you know, lots of these stories of small pockets. You know, Manchester as well is another area, and there are a lot of Jewish Manchester United fans, and celebrating those things is a really important thing. And Anthony Clavain, who both Amitai and I spoke to for our pieces, wrote a book, Does Your Rabbi Know You're Here, which kind of details out the untold stories of the Jewish community's connection and history with football, which a lot of people don't realise.
Amitai, tell us a little bit about the history that you uncovered, I guess, doing your dissertation, and then sort of told us about in this piece.
I think what was very interesting was that the assumption has always been that basically the Jewish community, when it first moved to Leeds, was very much like almost ghettoized in itself. I don't know if the word would be a ghetto, but it lived in like a very significantly defined pocket of the city of Leeds, and that pocket sort of moved northwards after they first arrived. In the sort of early part of the last century, they were concentrated in Chapel Town, early half of last century, and then as time went on, they moved further north and north to or Woodley, basically to a slightly nicer area of the city. Another thing they did at that time was they started to kind of look for ways to integrate into the city, and they started to become, and I think this happens with a lot of Jewish communities worldwide, because we're not traditionally very good athletes as a community, but we are massive sports obsessives. And I think that one of the things they latched onto initially was what was called Leeds Rugby at the time. It's now Leeds Rhinos, because that was the sport that everyone in the city was interested in. But then Don Revie comes along, and Don Revie is, you know, turns Leeds United from this provincial bang average football club into, and like, I'm saying this because I'm a Leeds fan, but I think it's fair to argue one of the best teams in Europe at that point. And they sort of, as a community, just drove towards Elland Road. He became part of the community in a sense that he moved into the community. Like, his house was around the corner from my dad's house when he was growing up. He played at the Jewish Golf Club. He, you know, one of his best friends was a Jewish guy who became involved with the club itself. But yeah, I think you know, one of the key things to bear in mind is, because the club became good at the same time as the Jewish fans became interested in it, they weren't like outliers on the terraces. They weren't like, oh, who are these new people who suddenly started showing up now that we're good? Everyone suddenly started showing up now Leeds were good. So it wasn't like they were considered glory supporters or like following a trend or jumping on the bandwagon. They were just part of this sudden urge to go watch Leeds United. And so it became this place. And I remember, like, weirdly enough, when I was doing my dissertation, I remember phoning my dad up and just speaking to him about it. And my dad, like, was from like a relatively comfortable family, but went to a comprehensive because at the time that was the school he could go to. And I remember him saying to me that the one thing he had in common with his mates from school, who had completely different backgrounds, ate different foods to him, went to different places on a weekend when it came to like religion, the one thing they all had in common was Leeds United. And that was how he became friends with them, basically. And that was the sort of history of the community in Leeds United. And I guess everything to do with that was that it was just this massive opportunity for people to integrate, to just become part of the city at large, essentially.
Do you think we've lost a little bit of that? I don't know. I mean, this is an open question to any of you, really. But do you think we've lost a bit of that in society now, where we often do forget how football can really bring us together, and it's become too tribal in many ways, and this story is such a brilliant example of the people who still find those overlaps, who still find that opportunity for football to bring them together. I don't know. I do sometimes feel like that there's a lot that's missing out of that.
I think because there's so much bad in the world, we tend to focus on the bad. And, you know, I'm not just saying this because I work for The Athletic, but this is where The Athletic, I find it really interesting, even before I worked for The Athletic, because you hear about things that you wouldn't necessarily have heard about. So, you know, I've read that Leeds piece this morning. It was something I had no knowledge of at all, and it was a heartwarming tale, and it shows football bringing people together of different backgrounds. But I think just because of the way the world is, there's so much bad going on, we tend to all just focus on that, don't we?
I think as well, some clubs, I don't know, there's a fear of celebrating their heritage and this sort of thing for fear of, you know, might that offend or alienate or something like that. And that's the point, that it's great when clubs are able to celebrate their history and the fact that they have these communities as part of it, and that does do a lot for assimilating different groups. And I mean, football was massive for Jewish immigrants and in sport in general. Like Amitai says, a lot of people, you know, football mads, when they came over, that was such a good way. People like my grandfather, and he was in Anthony Clavain's book because he played for Leyton Orient. He's one of the few kind of Jewish footballers that there's been. But for him, you know, that just made assimilation so much easier, because he was, you know, with most of his friends, I think he was a sportsman first and foremost rather than a Jew. And there are there are so many examples. You know, there are fan groups of different countries or different ethnicities, and The Athletic actually has profiled some of them as well. And, you know, the really heartwarming stories therein as well.
Amitai, are Leeds still quite active in those communities in terms of reaching out to Jewish fans, including them in Jewish holiday celebrations? I mean, is this something that the club are actively also trying to sort of celebrate? Like Charlie said, are they sort of recognising their own Jewish history as well?
I think it would be fair to say they're doing that more so than at any point in the past, currently. Last year, during the second lockdown, one of the rabbis, a guy called Albi, whose second name I forget, which isn't great of me, I'll just say a rabbi called Albi from one of the synagogues in North Leeds, he's been like doing prayers over live streams during lockdowns as a way of keeping the community together. And he did the annual Hanukkah sort of celebration, the lighting of the menorah, again over a live stream, and did it at Elland Road. He walked, if I remember right, he walked down the stairs of the East Stand singing one of the traditional songs to the tune of Marching On Together, which is the lead song. He, you know, this, and the club will have arranged for this, and that's a big thing. I think the other thing that sort of come up is, you know, I think it is mentioned in the piece, but my brother sort of deserves like a quite significant amount of recognition for something he's done recently, which is that he's worked very heavily with the club on a series of messages ahead of the Spurs game about anti-Semitism. And I think there's this you know, the players were involved in a video. I think it's one of the first times that I can remember personally, like, a club specifically speaking about anti-Semitism. And I have a sense that, like, the club wants to do more when it comes to that history in particular. I don't actually think the Jewish community needs loads of engagement when it comes to Leeds, because, like I say, like, there is just a significant amount of interest no matter what. I think something you mentioned there, which I think is quite interesting, is that actually something that's becoming more and more clear at Leeds is how welcoming it is to people of different backgrounds. Because when I was growing up, it was, you know, I say this because Jewish people are generally white looking, it was very like white as a fan base, basically, in part because of what happened with Lee Bowyer and Jonathan Woodgate in the early part of the millennium. But nowadays it's very, very like clearly more diverse as a football club, and I'm assuming there's been some engagement going on, and like, it's absolutely fantastic to see. I think Phil Hayes written a piece about in particular the Punjabi whites, they call themselves, but like, I think that there's more and more and more outreach to like different communities in Leeds, and actually I'm just delighted to see that, because I want to see the next generation of obsessive Leeds fans from a completely different migrant community.
I think football clubs in general are getting better. I went to an event at Villa Park last week with the Punjabi Villains. It was excellent, and it was great to hear some of their experiences of being Villa fans. Again, it's not stuff that you necessarily would know about or even consider. So I think you're right. I think football clubs in general are getting better. But just to summarise, Charlie, what happens next with Spurs? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, just on that, I mean, it was interesting there. Amitai referred to kind of the work that his brother did, and that led to in the Leeds' last home game before they went away to Spurs, there was a note in there saying, you know, please refrain from anti-Semitic chanting, and if you hear the Y word, basically that doesn't mean to use it. You know, it didn't explicitly say you're going to hear it at Spurs, but that was, you know, the message. So, but obviously there's a difference, because it's not so tied up with their identity now, in the way that now for Tottenham fans it is. Singing that word feels like, you know, a right, that's the way they feel. But what happens next? You know, we'll have the, you know, as and when it comes, this request from Tottenham fans to think about their usage of it. I hope that there are then campaigns on social media and this sort of thing, and whether that's led by clubs or by fan organizations, the challenge is, so much of it is not really internal at Tottenham, it's external. So, you know, we often have, you know, there are LGBTQ plus groups at various football clubs, you know, campaigning for diversity and equality, which is great. The challenge is that you're not necessarily going to have kind of Jewish Spurs fans groups you know, campaigning for an end to the Y word, because even therein there are divisions, you know, that most of the conformity comes from outside Spurs. So I think all the game stakeholders need to get their heads together and really think about how we can speak to the wider Jewish community and get these messages across, because it shouldn't just be about Tottenham, and Tottenham can only do so much, and they can only ask so many people, really, because their fan base is only 5% Jewish. So it for too long it's been framed as a kind of, this is what Spurs fans want, but it's really what the wider Jewish community wants, taking in Spurs Jewish fans as well. So it's going to be a challenge, but I just hope that these messages start to get across both at Tottenham and in the wider football community.
I mean, I certainly want to see clubs step up and do more, and I think it's brilliant to see what Leeds have been doing, putting messages in the programme, getting players involved in social media. I think other clubs can definitely learn from that, and being a bit more proactive. I think everything is so reactive, and when we saw the response to the Black Lives Matter movement, the way that it took so long to even get a reaction out of the league and the clubs, and that it was never very proactive. So I think it's brilliant to see clubs now realising that actually they need to play their part, because fan groups have been doing that on their own accord for so long to no avail, that now finally, you know, leagues and clubs are realising actually we have to step up our efforts. So hopefully it's the beginning of some real positive change as well.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to speak to you both. I've certainly learned a lot from the podcast and from doing the reading on The Athletic as well. So thanks ever so much for coming on the show today, guys.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having us.
Cheers for having us.
So still time to highlight some of the great writing that's up on The Athletic right now. And Flo, I haven't read this story yet, but I'm going to. I need to catch up. If you don't read The Athletic for a few days, you go on there and there's just all sorts that you haven't read. But Andy Mitten's done a piece on Etienne Capoue saying, "I don't watch football, not even a game a year. I don't know the opposition players until my coaches tell me." Now, as I say, I've not read the piece. I feel like you should know a little bit yourself as a professional footballer, maybe.
I know, it's always funny, actually. There's a lot of players I find that when you chat to them, like, honestly, like, football is my job, but actually I can't think of anything less that I want to do when I get home. I want to switch off and not be involved in it. But it's a really interesting article, actually, because obviously they're playing Manchester United on Tuesday night, and he talks about how his dad's a Man U fan, and obviously Villarreal have played Man U Europa League final recently, and have already played them, so in the group stages of the Champions League. So it's a really interesting piece about what he hopes to achieve, and how important it is for him to play against Manchester United. And yeah, he seems like a very interesting character. I never really heard that much from him when he played at Watford. I don't really know. I didn't really know what he was like as a personality, but he seems like quite a funny guy. So yeah, an interesting read.
He's at Spurs as well for a bit. I think I remember him having a real good goal scoring run at Watford in the Premier League at one point. But yeah, I'm definitely going to go and check that out. Is there anything else you've been enjoying? I mean, I've been all in on reading Steven Gerrard stuff, to be fair, over the last 7 days. That's where I've been.
Yeah, you've been doing your research. You've been doing your research, haven't you? I mean, obviously, yeah. There's all the brilliant Manchester United pieces. I've written a piece on the weekend about Manchester United women's side, because they've been hoping to sort of push into the big three of women's football, but this season they keep conceding late goals and their game management is a bit poor. They've been making some really basic mistakes. So it's kind of a bit of a look at that with some stats as well. And I did a sort of similar piece last week looking at stats and looking at who could get the third Champions League spot in the WSL, because at the moment there's a couple of sort of surprising clubs in there, Brighton and Spurs being the most surprising options. And it's kind of looking at actually come the end of the season, it might be Manchester City who've had the worst start to a season in their history who actually still get the third Champions League spot. So yeah, I will I'll blow my own trumpet for those ones as well if people want to check it out.
Manchester City women have the worst start that they've had, but they still beat Aston Villa women 5-0 at the weekend.
Yeah, sorry about that. It was a bit of a capitulation. Villa completely fell apart.
I know.
They were playing really well for first half and they just completely fell apart. But hey ho, it's a long old season, so don't worry, Dan.
I'll be sure to go and read your piece as well and press the like button or the it's
oh,
great
thanks.
Button.
The smiley face.
The smiley face. The good button.
The smiley face, yeah.
I'll press the good button. I've done it a few times when I've read my Aston Villa partners' pieces, Greg Evans I've clicked the wrong button by mistake, and I had to apologise if you do that. I don't know what happens if you press the wrong button by mistake. I don't know how that works, but yeah, I'll make sure I press the right one. So thanks as ever to you, Flo, and thanks to our two fantastic guests as well for their contribution today. And of course, thank you to everyone for listening as well. Please, please do get involved in the comments section. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And wherever you do get your podcasts, if you are enjoying the show, then please leave us a review too. This was the Athletic Football Podcast. Mark Chapman and Matt Slater will be back with another episode tomorrow, so please, please join us again.
The Athletic.